Next is what I would consider to be the high point of our banquet tonight, and that's our keynote speaker, Pam Allen. Pam is not only the treasurer of the NFB at the national level, but she is director of the Louisiana Center for the Blind. The NFB training centers, we have three of those, are very special places. These are centers that literally change the lives of people, and to be a director of one of those requires an unbelievable amount of skill and talent and just an unbelievable type of feeling for the people and the staff, and there's all sorts of things to consider. There's money flow and a zillion other things that a director has to consider. So any of the directors of a center are, in my estimation, very, very special people. So with that, I'd like to have Pam Allen come up and give our keynote address.
Thank you very much, Bob, for those kind words. And good evening to everybody. A crazy quilt is a unique conglomeration of randomly pieced fancy fabrics with embroidered embellishments on nearly every seam and patch. But it did not start out this way. The evolution of the crazy quilt, as we recognize it today, is a journey that illustrates the triumph of women's imaginativeness and ingenuity in the face of unimaginable trials and tribulations. The random practice of piecing odd bits of cloth together was a money-saving habit from colonial times. In the harsh and unfamiliar environment of the New World, the biggest factors needed to build a strong and enduring society required that early settlers be hardworking, with a strong sense of responsibility, first to family and then to community. In the beginning, when the coverlets and blankets the colonists had brought with them began to wear out, they were patched until the cloth could no longer hold thread. By necessity, self-sufficient, and by temperament, eminently practical, when clothing and bedclothes wore out, they were recycled. Worn parts were cut away, and any useful pieces were recombined. From these pieced odds and ends, we can readily envision how the crazy quilt came into being. It was indeed crazy as far as design was concerned. There was no planned design and shape, arrangement of colors, or use of materials. However, the finished product united diverse types and colors of materials into one useful and beautiful piece of work. It can only be surmised from what is known of conditions prevailing at the time how these quilts made by the earliest colonial women must have looked. Not very pretty, because they were composed only of the stronger, though already worn, pieces of material, cut from otherwise unserviceable clothing and reinforced by newer materials when spots became worn. These quilts were made more as a result of accident born of necessity than design. They were used for practical reasons, of course, but they also chronicled the stories of families passed down from generation to generation. Younger women learned techniques from their elders and experimented with them to form new ideas and patterns. Many times, quilt making was, and still is today, a communal activity. Women would gather for quilting bees where they could not only share pieces of fabric, but could also enjoy each other's company and give one another support. Although each of them may not have had enough fabric to create a quilt, by combining their resources, they learned about the importance of teamwork. Quilting bees provided early colonial women a social outlet and a time for fellowship. These women realized that they were not alone. They understood the power of working together to form a beautiful masterpiece sewn with love and patience. As blind people, we can relate to the experiences of the early settlers of our country. We too face challenges and adversity. Many times our ideas are undervalued or maybe unappreciated. Oftentimes we may feel like we are the only ones. Although we may have dreams and hopes for the future, we may not reach our fullest potential because of lack of self-confidence, lack of opportunity, or low expectations. I became blind when I was about 2 years old as a result of retinoblastoma, a type of cancer. Although my parents were shocked by my loss of sight, they fortunately realized that I was still the same child, except that I could no longer see. Through their love and high expectations, they instilled in me a sense of pride and confidence about my ability to succeed. My parents expected me to perform household chores and do my best in school and participate in family activities. Growing up as the youngest of 6 children also helped me to learn to be independent. Being the youngest, nobody, especially my brother, who was a year older than I, let me get away with anything. I'm very grateful to my parents and siblings for giving me such a loving and solid foundation and always setting a high standard. I attended the same preschool as the rest of my siblings in a suburb of Buffalo, and when it was time to enroll in kindergarten, my parents wanted me to attend the same elementary school as well. Since the small private Catholic school had never had a blind child, staff members were slightly uncertain. She'd be the only one, they said, and were not quite sure what to do. Since recently passed federal mandates gave my parents the right to educate me in the setting of their choice, they remained committed. Their persistence paid off, and soon I was enrolled. My mother is an avid reader who believed firmly in the importance of developing strong literacy skills. She read to us from infancy on and instilled in us a love of learning and reading. Consequently, my mother and father expected me to learn to read, just like my other siblings. Even though I would be reading Braille instead of print, my parents knew that I could be as efficient as my sighted peers, as long as I read every day. It wasn't amazing or spectacular that I read Braille. It was simply the expectation for equality and literacy. Fortunately, my itinerant teacher also provided me with a sound foundation in Braille, which helped me excel in academics. As I mentioned earlier, my parents expected me to do my best and to engage in activities that would make me a well-rounded person. I participated in horseback riding, downhill skiing, and cheerleading during school. Another of my hobbies was performing in our school musicals. In 8th grade, I tried out for our production of The Wizard of Oz. I remember being surprised and excited because I had made it to the second auditions. I was trying out for the part of Glinda, the Good Witch. Even though I was nervous on the day of auditioning, I knew I had done my best. When the cast list was posted, however, my name was not on it. Instead of having a lead, I received a chorus part. I remember overhearing from teachers that I might have gotten the part, except that the choreographer wasn't sure how I could handle the dancing and moving around on stage. At the time, although I'd received some O&M instruction, I did not feel comfortable using or even being seen with my cane. So I had to depend on my friends to get places. Although I was encouraged to use a cane, I mistakenly believed that I was somehow more independent by not using a cane and depending on others. Since I was the only one, the only blind child the director knew, she couldn't imagine how I could perform the role of Glenda. Fortunately, my friends and family reassured me that they knew that I could have, but I secretly wondered how. My parents had been actively involved in organizing and maintaining a group for blind children and their families when I was younger, and I attended summer programs for blind kids. But the combination of everyone's busy schedules and hectic lives had caused the parents' group to disband. Since I didn't really have, or at the time want, much contact with other blind kids, and didn't really know many competent blind adults, my questions about performing in musicals went unanswered. During high school, I continued to stay involved with extracurricular activities, performing in vocal ensemble, doing community service, Model UN, and having fun with my friends, of course. Like other teenagers, I was ready to get a job. I knew that I would have to support my shopping habit after all, so I was eager. My mom and dad had stressed the importance of hard work and responsibility, and I was anxious to try my hand at working. My family owned a grocery store, and I'd often helped around the store when I was growing up, but I wasn't interested in working there. I wanted to earn a job based on my own abilities and talents. I remember searching through newspapers and making phone calls. As I mentioned before, while growing up, I'd had limited contact with other blind people my age. In general, I had no desire to associate with people who were blind. In fact, even though I'm totally blind, I remember telling prospective employers that I had eye problems. I had always been taught that my blindness was not a barrier and that my positive attitude about blindness was critical for success. But when I was applying for jobs, the employers wouldn't give me a chance, it seemed. It seemed like when the issue of blindness came up, the jobs had miraculously been filled. Once again, I was the only one. Of course, my parents and I knew that I could figure out a way to do the job if I'd only get the chance. So finally, I landed a job selling subscriptions for the local newspaper. And if any of you have ever done telemarketing, you know that it's not easy, especially when your paycheck is based solely on the number of subscriptions you sell. But I was happy and grateful that someone had given me a chance, and I try to remember that experience and be friendly when someone calls me on the phone trying to sell me something. I realized that every high school senior experiences some trepidation about the transition to adulthood and independence. And as high school graduation approached, I began to have questions that my sighted peers couldn't answer. I knew that I would attend college and eventually find a job, but I wondered if I would truly be able to obtain employment. After all, I'd had so much difficulty trying to find part-time work. I'd also never lived on my own, and I wondered how successful I'd be. I wanted to get married and raise a family, but I wondered how a blind person could be a successful and competent parent. After all, I'd had questions from people when I was trying to find work as a babysitter during high school. I knew I wanted to travel and attend a college away from home, but I didn't feel very comfortable or confident still about using my cane. My O&M instruction while growing up had been sporadic, and I felt awkward and clumsy when walking with a cane, and it just still seemed so much easier and faster to go sighted guide. I knew, though, that I didn't know another soul at the college in which I had enrolled, so the test of my independence would soon arrive. Once again, my strong support network of friends and family definitely encouraged me, but they couldn't give me advice on how blind people traveled and lived independently, for most of them, I was the only one that they knew. Growing up, I'd had limited interaction with or knowledge of the NFB. But I was encouraged by my family and teachers to advocate for myself. I entered Denison University in Ohio with some apprehension, but I was determined to achieve the best. The small liberal arts college provided me with an exciting environment for learning and growing. But those unanswered questions still nagged at me. If people were so amazed that I could accomplish the most insignificant tasks, would they really treat me as an equal? I realized that I had to meet other blind people who had more experience and who could serve as role models. I knew I needed to learn some tricks of the trade. My search exposed me to a wide variety of groups and organizations of and for the blind. Although I definitely benefited from the social interaction I found, I wasn't sure about the rest of the package. I wasn't interested in finding a group of people who wanted the world to change by making unnecessary accommodations, or who were bitter and felt sorry for themselves because they believed blindness was a tragedy. I was interested in finding a group of people who were confident and competent and who wanted to be treated as equals. It was not until I attended a student seminar hosted by the National Federation of the Blind of Ohio during the fall of my sophomore year of college that I began to find the answers for which I had been searching. Finally, I met young, motivated blind people. We swapped our stories, and I couldn't believe how many experiences we shared. Although I didn't realize it at the time, the seminar marked the beginning of a new chapter of my life. At the seminar, I met Barbara Pierce, who was president of the NFB of Ohio at the time, and she told me about the Louisiana Center for the Blind. At that time, I was searching for an internship opportunity, and she spoke with Joanne Wilson, who was the director at the time, and arranged for me to complete an internship at the center during the following May. Barbara told me that spending time at the center would allow me to discover the heart of the NFB philosophy, and I wasn't quite sure what she meant, but I soon learned. Throughout the year prior to my internship, she patiently listened while I asked questions and tried to understand the differences among the various organizations of and for the blind, and I had a lot of questions. I also began reading the Braille Monitor, and I was amazed and enlightened by the articles. I couldn't believe some of the stories I read about instances of discrimination. I was also motivated by the articles which discussed employment opportunities. I was finally beginning to learn about blindness from people who had firsthand experience. And by the time May approached, I was eager to be immersed in the activities at the center in Ruston. During my internship, I was challenged and empowered, and I was forced to confront my own misconceptions about blindness. And I began to discover the power of collective action. Upon completion of the internship, I had the honor of working as a counselor in the Children's Summer Program, and I believe I learned more that summer than I taught. Little did I know that the opportunity would alter my life forever. I met so many wonderful role models to whom I could turn for advice, and I had a chance to share my experiences with blind children and their families. Prior to that summer, I'd never even considered the possibility of working with blind people. In fact, I'd intentionally avoided working in the field of blindness. I didn't realize that not everyone had been exposed to high expectations at home and high-quality training in the skills of blindness. Of course, sometimes I felt like one of those early colonial women. I was in a new place, very new to the philosophy of the NFB. However, I realized that I had discovered a new support network. I was no longer the only one. I had discovered another family who believed in me, sometimes more than I believed in myself. I returned to college that fall with a new sense of commitment to my blind brothers and sisters. Shortly after, I participated in an off-campus internship in Philadelphia. And as part of that experience, students were required to research, locate, and interview for internships. We had about 2 weeks to secure positions. The program was well-known and well-respected in the Philadelphia area, so many private and governmental agencies offered spots for internships. At that time, I was intending to pursue a career in clinical psych or law, and I decided to investigate internship opportunities with local advocacy and public interest agencies. I believed that my academic achievements and demonstration of leadership abilities would enable me to obtain an internship, which would challenge me and enrich my life. I narrowed my search to about 5 agencies. One of my top choices was with an attorney who specialized in advocacy and women's and children's issues. The description sounded perfect for me. I expected the attorney to have an open mind and be willing to listen as I answered any questions that she might have. But I was shocked at her reaction. Not only was she unreceptive, she essentially refused to entertain the idea that I could possibly perform the job duties efficiently and independently. I knew that I could, but she was unwilling to consider the idea. I believe that each of us has defining moments in our lives which shape our future, and for me, the experience with the attorney was such a moment. I could not believe that she had reacted so negatively and doubted my capabilities simply based on my blindness. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, I'd read about instances of discrimination in the Braille Monitor, but I always thought that something like that would never happen to me. My experience seemed to bring home the point that although great strides have been made, many stereotypes and misconceptions still exist about blindness. Fortunately, at the time in my life, I knew about the National Federation of the Blind. I knew where to turn for advice and support. Coincidentally, the Washington seminar happened to be about the same time I was interviewing for internships. And I had heard about Washington seminar while I was in Louisiana and through the Braille Monitor. Since I was so close, I decided to take the train from Philadelphia to D.C. The timing could not have been better. I connected with leaders in the student division with whom I could share my experience. I also met members of the local chapter in Philadelphia with whom I kept in touch upon my return. And I was thoroughly amazed by what I saw and experienced in Washington. The Washington seminar was my first large NFB event, and I returned to Philadelphia with more confidence and a renewed spirit. I landed a wonderful internship with a much more open-minded attorney, and I was nurtured by my Federation friends in Philadelphia. I had the chance to work with the National Association of Blind Students and help organize student divisions in several states. Later that semester, I visited the attorney who denied me and presented her with Federation literature. I hoped that our meeting would force her to confront her negative ideas and see the truth about blindness. That summer, I attended my first national convention in New Orleans as a national scholarship winner, another life-changing event. I was inspired and motivated by what I experienced there. And like some of you here this weekend, I was also a bit overwhelmed and unsure. Throughout the week, I met and talked with countless NFB leaders who took the time to share their stories with me. Hearing Dr. Jernigan and Dr. Maurer speak for the first time was incredible. I couldn't believe that Dr. Maurer took time out of his busy schedule to speak with me personally to talk about my dreams and hopes. Before, I had thought that I was not like other blind people. But I began to feel a tremendous bond with my blind brothers and sisters. Just like colonial women pieced together their random bits of fabric to make a quilt, which told a story of their lives, I began to learn how to weave my story with the stories of the leaders who had come before me. I realized that their hard work and advocacy efforts had created the opportunities that I now had. I learned that a small group of committed people with limited resources had started the NFB in 1940. I met blind people from diverse backgrounds who were truly committed to changing what it means to be blind. Over the next few years, my work in the student division enabled me to strengthen my beliefs in our philosophy. Through the sharing of our stories, I began to understand the importance of working together for a common purpose. After graduation from college, I decided to become a student at the Louisiana Center for the Blind. Some of my friends and family wondered why I decided to enroll at the center. They said, "You already know Braille, you have good skills, you finished college." But I knew that I needed to be immersed in our philosophy, to learn more about the history of our movement, and to strengthen my skills and self-confidence. Shortly after my graduation from the center, I became employed full-time as the director of youth services there. During my tenure as director of youth services, my life was enriched in so many ways. I met countless numbers of parents and teachers and blind children and teenagers who also felt like they were the only ones. I saw firsthand the importance of holding high expectations in order to achieve success. I witnessed how the Federation philosophy touched and transformed lives forever. I'm proud to say that many of our summer program participants are now active leaders in the National Association of Blind Students and in their state NFB affiliates and local chapters. As a result of my work in Ruston, I also met an incredibly talented and dynamic cane travel instructor with a passion for life and teaching. As I'm sure you guessed, that wonderful person, Roland, later became my husband. Roland's love and support have made so many of my dreams come true. And as I said earlier, involvement in the NFB has many benefits. Often in our Federation family, we are called upon for a wide variety of duties. And sometimes we question whether or not we can truly rise to the occasion. You're probably familiar with the expression, life begins at 30. A few years ago, I experienced such a time in my life. At the end of 2000, I turned 30. And little did I know how my life would change. In 2001, Joanne Wilson was appointed as Commissioner of the Rehabilitation Services Administration, and I was appointed as Director of the Louisiana Center for the Blind. It was quite a year since I also became President of the NFB of Louisiana, became engaged, planned a wedding, got married, bought a house. It was a busy time. I know that it was my Federation family who helped me get through that chaotic year. The following summer, I had the tremendous honor of being elected to the NFB National Board of Directors. And in 2006, I was honored to become the National Treasurer. Now in my current position as president of our Louisiana affiliate, director of the Louisiana Center for the Blind, and treasurer, I am challenged to live and spread our philosophy each day. I am blessed to see the evidence that our philosophy works. By teaching blind people the skills of blindness, instilling in them self-confidence, and most importantly, giving them the gift of the National Federation of the Blind, I witness incredible transformations on a daily basis. When our students enter the program, many times they feel isolated and anxious about their prospects for future. Their dreams have been shattered, but because of their commitment and hard work, and because of the dedication of our staff, they leave our center changed forever, with spirits strengthened and renewed. Just the other day, one of our new students said, "Thank you to the staff because You push me out of my comfort zone. Each day, as I watch our students grow and stretch themselves, my belief and commitment to the NFB are strengthened. Being the director is a challenging job, but because of the belief and support of my Federation family, I know that I can be successful because we are all working together, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity it allows me to give back. Just as early colonial women came together at Quilting Bees for encouragement and support, we come together at our local, state, and national meetings and conventions. I know that you'll agree with me when I say that there's an amazing sense of empowerment when thousands of Federationists gather together on the first day of our national convention and President Maurer calls the convention to order, or the pride and the commitment we feel to each other when legislation like our Pedestrian Safety Enhancement Act is signed into law, or at events like the Rolex 24, the Blind Driver Challenge, where we witness history being made because of our efforts, and most importantly, our belief in the capabilities of blind people. Just like the early quilts, the NFB is made up of a diverse group of people who bring their individual talents and strengths together to form a stronger unit. As we reflect on the achievements of the National Federation of the Blind of Illinois this weekend, remember that there are thousands of Federationists around this country cheering you on. It takes a group of committed people who are willing to sacrifice their time, energy, and resources. A sacrifice that will truly make a difference. Dr. Tenbrook, Dr. Jernigan, Dr. Maurer, and our national and state leaders have nurtured us and shared their wisdom and stories with younger generations. Because of the National Federation of the Blind, we now have a whole new generation of blind people who've been empowered by the truth about blindness, and we've seen that here this weekend. Our combined stories have become blocks of a living quilt, stitched together with threads of love, loyalty, hope, sacrifice, and commitment. A tribute to our past and a legacy to which future generations will add their stories. And so, as we come together tonight to share with each other, to celebrate our accomplishments, and plan for our future by turning our dreams into reality, we become stronger as we experience the power of the blind, speaking with one voice. We are here this weekend to celebrate the collective action and the spirit of independence embodied by the National Federation of the Blind. We are here to pay tribute to the leaders of our movement who paved the way for us by their sacrifice and example, so we might enjoy the freedoms we now have. We are here this weekend to make a difference, to build a future full of promise and opportunity. We're counting on you. Together we stand, and united as one, we cannot be defeated. We are the National Federation of the Blind. Thank you.